Welcome to Reclaiming the Republic. This show is sponsored by ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. I am G.R. Mobley. This is an educational grassroots program focused on uniting and leading in restoring the Republic and placing the federal government back into the scope and framework of the Constitution once again. And welcome back, and it is now or never, and that debt is fraud, and it's all about compliance of the Constitution, folks. If we do not hold our public servants accountable to their oath of office and demand the rule of law like we just covered yesterday, then we don't have a rule of law. We have tyranny, and we are being subject to the whims and desires of those who are governing us, almost like we have kings. And believe it or not, when you look at the elected, your elected officials, they truly believe that they're a class or royalty better than you. They believe that they're wielding the power, that you are nothing to them. And in a way, they're right. Because at this point in time, you and your fellow ilk or your, you know, family, local community, and so forth, are not together resolved in saying, we're holding them accountable to the law. The problem is we have to start adulting up. We have to realize that these little benefits that they're giving us is how they're using, or actually how they're dividing and conquering us. You have to admit that I've got to give up these benefits. The one benefit, folks, that I believe that we do not have to give up, we can still dismantle it, but ensure that nobody is harmed, is Social Security. Everything else, every other welfare project out there needs to stop. It needs, because they're stealing from Peter to pay Paul. And all of those things can't be done. But everybody that has been promised this retirement thing, that's got to end as well. All kids and all young men and women who are capable of moving forward and making their own plans for their own retirement, that's fine. Let them do that. If you want to have a retirement plan, then set it up in your state. If you want to have a retirement plan, your state should actually have its own exchange. What do I mean by that? The New York Stock Exchange, the Chicago Exchange, the London Exchange. Why is it that everybody is throwing all their money and all the money is in circulation in these few exchanges when every state has the ability to have its own exchange? So all businesses that are formed and operated within your state would be within your exchange instead of under the New York Stock Exchange, where you have no control over the outcome of that. You can't get justice from New York. This SEC is unconstitutional, and the fact that they're regulating that thing is unconstitutional as well. If you start peeling the onion, you start realizing that everything is local. We need to restore our hybrid constitutional republic. In so doing, we actually have to control those things that we need to control. Do you need to control your state exchange? Probably so. Let's not let the globalists control all of it. Maybe there's some states out there the globalists are deep in, but if you're in a good state, you're going to be in control of your entire destiny. And you can take back from the globalists at your state level. Right now, we can see how hard it is from the toehold that they've gotten, or I should say the foothold, or maybe I should say the vestige that they've established in controlling us. So don't forget, please support Jerry Wistrand in his campaign for auditor for Missouri. With that, welcome back, Sean.
Good to be here, sir. Thank you.
And boy, is this some good stuff we've got. We've got some good stuff we're going to go through.
Absolutely.
And so... Yeah, we're getting closer to the militia stuff, where there's so many good things that's coming up that I'm looking forward to. Now, down here, Mr. Grayson, this is on Wednesday, June 11th, and Mr. Grayson, down here on page 152, he makes this, I've labeled it Note to Sovereigns. As we kind of mentioned yesterday, that when we really look at our government, when we create a government and delegate power to it, we have delegated a level of sovereignty to that government. Now, this, in today's world, I think most people can kind of start to understand how the distribution of power, limited powers, can be distributed so that there's no conflicts. We can see that. Back in these days, they had a real problem. And as a matter of fact, Mr. Grayson really had a hard time understanding this. And I don't want to call him the dimmest bulb on the tree, but he really was asking some questions that to me really spoke out that he wasn't a forefront for the anti-federalist. He was somebody that was really trying to understand what was going on. And so let's look at his comment regarding this, because, again, the paradigm was that you can only have one sovereign. You can only have one king. How can you have stages of kings? It was beyond his grasp. Let's go ahead.
As to direct taxation, give up this and you give up everything, as it is the highest act of sovereignty. Surrender up this inestimable jewel and you throw away a pearl richer than all your tribe. But it has been said by an honorable gentleman, Mr. Pendleton, as well as I recollect, that there could be no such thing as an interference between the two legislatures, either in point of direct taxation or another any other case whatsoever. An honorable gentleman, Mr. Mason, has replied that they might interfere in the case of a poll tax. I will go farther and say that the case may happen in the judiciary. Suppose a state execution and a federal execution issued against the same man, and the state officer and federal officer seized him at the same moment. Would they divide the man in two, as Solomon directed the child to be divided, who is claimed by two women? I suppose the general government, as being paramount, would prevail. How are two legislatures to coincide with powers transcendent, supreme, and omnipotent? For such is the definition of a legislature. There must be an external interference, not only in the collection of taxes, but in the judiciary. Was there ever such a thing in any country before? Great Britain never went so far in the Stamp Act. Poyning's law, the abhorrence of the Irish, never went so far. I never heard of two supreme coordinate powers in one and the same country before. I cannot conceive how it can happen. It surpasses everything that I have read of concerning other governments, or that I can conceive by the utmost exertion of my faculties.
Okay, so one of the things that, you know, like he brings up Mason, and he's in this paradigm that you can only have one supreme, because he doesn't understand the power of attorney concept, the limited power of attorney concept, or the specified powers delegated, that they can't meddle with anything other than that. This is clearly in the same day where, this is the day after Nicholas. So maybe he was out. Maybe he was in the commode while Mr. Nicholas was, talking about the king's prerogative, and, if being in an opposite, if Congress doesn't have the power, they can't meddle with it, as you kind of alluded to, how that was such a powerful, succinct comment, the way he articulated that. Well, maybe he missed that, because as far as I'm concerned, that really was probably the best articulation at this point to kind of lay out how the king, may have these general powers, where your state may have general powers, but the federal government has power supreme, and over these very specific powers, they are supreme. So if there are coinciding powers, then they are supreme. But let's look at some of his examples. He says that they might interfere in the case of a poll tax. No, they can't. They have no execution powers of an election. The elections are ran by the states. They do not run them. So they can't, and they don't have any authority for, you know, laying out a poll tax, right? Their authority of taxation is a direct tax or duty, a excise tax, and what was the other one? Oh, imposts, which is basically taxes on goods coming in, you know, foreign goods. That's it. They would have to pass a law to say we now have the ability to tax elections, people who are choosing to vote, and create a poll tax. They don't have the authority to do that. So why that would even come in as an opportunity to say they could do that, and I think that's what Mr. Mason stated. And remember, again, Mr. Mason was a good guy, but he was so caught up on this Bill of Rights thing. Mr. Grayson, he says, I will go further and say that the case may happen in the judiciary. Suppose a state execution and a federal execution issued against the same man. The state officer and federal officer sees him at the same moment. Would they divide him in two? How is it there's only one law where the federal government has the authority to execute a man? And what is that law?
I'm not sure. Treason.
There you go, treason. So let's just say in the commission of treason, a man kills and murders somebody within their state where they're committing the treason. And the state officer says, we're charging you for murder. And the federal government comes in and says, we're charging you for treason. Now, they're two different charges. And with the Fifth Amendment, you know, double jeopardy, one man can be tried for treason and be found innocent and then be back to the state and be tried for murder and be found guilty because they're two separate crimes. They may have been committed in the same act, but they're two separate crimes. Where the federal government, under treason, the Constitution's clear. They have jurisdiction over that. And so they can seek justice. Now, this is where I believe that there would be a dialogue instead of the federal government coming in and saying, we're going to try him first. And there, it may be one of those political things to say, we want to make sure that, you know, these people, like with the Whiskey Rebellion, these people get charged with treason. They didn't get executed. Those who were convicted with treason were pardoned by George Washington. That doesn't mean that their murders would have been pardoned had they committed murder. That would go back to the states, and these men would then still face the crime of what they committed in addition to their act of treason. The point is this is where, you know, I can see posturing and politics getting involved, but there's no splitting of the person. There can't be a double jurisdiction of treason. When it comes to treason of the U.S. Constitution, the United States government has precedence and they have sole jurisdiction. They can allow that person to be tried in the state prior to them trying them for treason if they chose to, or vice versa. It's not about splitting. It's about sole jurisdiction. All crimes that the federal government has the right to punish as well as define the punishments thereof, which is basically counterfeiting. Here's the two crimes committed within the United States. Counterfeiting and treason. Now, can a person be charged by the state for counterfeiting U.S. coin? No. Okay. So how is it that he gets into this, he creates a paradigm that you can't logically, it's like, I understand that a person can take 2 + 2 and make it something other than 4 if you change the mathematical expressions. Now, you're a math teacher?
No, sir.
Okay. So
I was an English teacher.
But my point is that in almost every aspect, when somebody just says the words 2 + 2 = 4, the expressions being provided verbally, it means 4, and that is the only outcome. You can, by using expressions on a piece of paper, take 2 plus 2 with, again, of the application of expressions, and that would be a different number altogether because of the way the formula that you're applying to it would work. The point is that in most all cases of logic and reason, like math, you would always have, you know, a very specified outcome. Very specified. There's no subjectivity to it at all. When we look at the crimes of, you know, counterfeiting and or treason against the Constitution, both of those are owned jurisdiction-wise, and defining the punishment, the crime, so forth, that's all done by the federal government. The state can't be involved in that. So for those crimes, if the U.S. government comes in and says, we want jurisdiction over this, and if they play politics or what have you, you know, then they could probably supersede and say, we're taking the guy first. We need to make sure that we nip this in the bud, because it's not just a problem in your state. We've seen these insurrections, and we've seen the treasonous acts in 2020 with all of these people. We need to start trying these people for treason like they should have, just like they did with the Whiskey Rebellion, and hang some of these people. That would right there change the sentiments of these Bolsheviks that are out in the streets burning, destroying property, and so forth. You know, it just requires the witness of two people to secure that that person committed that crime. Then that person committed treason, and now they can be hanged. See, I think that at that point, I would believe that it would be better for the federal government to try those people in Seattle and in all these different places where the uprising occurred, and they'd be hanged. Simple. Because now people understand the magnitude of the crime being committed. Everybody thought there was a right. They had a right to do that. No, you were committing a crime. It's a crime. You have no right to deny, disparage, or take away the rights of others. And in Seattle, the autonomous zone, destroying property because you don't like the laws, because you want something different, you want a different outcome? I'm sorry. That right there is treason. So, and as a matter of fact, most people have tried to redefine. Don't let anybody redefine treason for you, folks. Because there's people out there saying, oh, well, we have to be at war for somebody to commit treason against the United States. No. These folks that are actually allowing the invasion to occur and to continue, they're committing treason. They should be hanged. By definition, that is treason, because they're failing to support the Constitution and giving aid and comfort to the enemy thereof. These people coming in here defying and denying us our rights and our laws. Now we go back into the next day. Grayson speaks again. Then Mr. Pendleton gets up and tries to explain back to Mr. Grayson some things regarding common law and so forth. So let's dive into the comment regarding common law here.
There will be deviations even in our state legislatures thus constituted. I say, and I hope to give no offense when I do, there have been some. I believe every gentleman will see that it is unconstitutional to condemn any man without a fair trial. Such a condemnation is repugnant to the principles of justice. It is contrary to the Constitution and the spirit of the common law. Look at the Bill of Rights. You find there that no man shall be condemned without being confronted with his accusers and witnesses, that every man has a right to call for evidence in his favor, and above all, to a speedy trial by an impartial jury of the vicinage, without whose unanimous consent he cannot be found guilty. These principles have not been attended to. An instance has been mentioned already where they have been in some degree violated.
Okay, and then Mr. Pendleton kind of spoke softly, and they couldn't, you know, write it down. All right, and then he goes on a bit and hits this comments regarding direct taxes, where Mr. Monroe kind of piped up something earlier. So go ahead.
A gentleman, Mr. Monroe, has said that the power of direct taxation was unnecessary because the imposts and backlands would be abundantly sufficient to answer all federal purposes. If so, what are we disputing about? I asked the gentleman who made the observation and this committee if they believe that Congress will ever lay direct taxes if the other funds are sufficient. It would then remain a harmless power upon paper and do no injury. If it should be necessary, would gentlemen run the risk of the union by withholding it? I was sorry to hear the subjects of requisitions and taxation misinterpreted. The latter has been compared to taxation by Great Britain without our own consent. The two cases are by no means similar. The King of Great Britain has not the purse, though he holds the sword. He has no means of using the sword but by requisitions on those who hold the purse. He applied to the British Parliament, and they were pleased to trust him with our money. We declared, as we had a right, that we ought to be taxed by our own representatives, and that therefore their disposing of our money without our consent was unjust. Here, requisitions are to be made by one body of our representatives to another. Why should this be the case when they are both possessed of our equal confidence, both chosen in the same manner and equally responsible to us? But we are told that there will be a war between the two bodies, equally our representatives, and that the state government will be destroyed and consolidated into the general government. I stated before that this could not be so. The two governments act in different manners and for different purposes. The general government and great national concerns in which we are interested in common with other members of the union. The state legislature in our mere local concerns. Is it true or merely imaginary that the state legislatures will be confined to the care of bridges and roads? I think that they are still possessed of the highest powers. Our dearest rights, life, liberty, and property, as Virginians, are still in the hands of our state legislature. If they prove too feeble to protect us, we resort to the aid of the general government for security. The true distinction is that the two governments are established for different purposes and act on different objects, so that, notwithstanding what the worthy gentleman said, I believe I am still correct and insist that if each power is confined within its proper bounds and to its proper objects, an interference can never happen. Being for two different purposes, as long as they are limited to different objects, they can no more clash than two parallel lines can meet. Both lay taxes, but for different purposes. The same officers may be used by both governments, which will prevent a number of inconveniences. If an invasion or insurrection or other misfortune should make it necessary for the general government to interpose, this will be for the general purposes of the Union and for the manifest interest of the states.
Okay, so I think he does a pretty decent job in laying it out there, because he's right. Parallel lines can't meet. Governments that have very specific powers that are different from each other, in other words, they may be going in the same direction, but they're not intersecting. There's no intersection at all. And so this can't happen unless either one or both decide to contraconvene or, you know, integrate outside of the law and start working together. Because when we look at how we are being manipulated by the federal government by using money to do their bidding, that's not constitutional. So in other words, every time we see our government doing things that it shouldn't be doing, whether it be the state being the bad actor or the federal government being the bad actors are acting outside the powers and are violating the Constitution. So in other words, when government is taking away our rights, violating, regulating us in ways that they don't have the authority, even to today, they are still violations of the Constitution. It's really that simple. The only reason we're dealing with it is because we're allowing them to violate our constitutions. We'll be right back after this. If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review as well as my description of the Republic Review model on ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how Republic Review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you. As a reminder, if you have any questions or comments, we have a 24-hour comment line, 425-270-5416. Okay, so so that kind of ends the 12th. And now Friday, June 13th, you know, a lot goes on. A lot goes on. They just they go through a lot. And as a matter of fact, if you just went to the June 13th, that would be page 179, and then you go to June 14th, that takes you to page 197. So it's almost 20 pages of dialogue. That's a lot in one day, a lot. And so they cover all of these details. And now, as they go further and further and further, in some of these details, folks, and I need to get back through this because I need to highlight it. There is a point in time where they start talking about population centers and the danger of population centers being able to control government by using democracy, and why they, you know, are using a Republican form of government and so forth. But as we go through here on Saturday, June 14th, and as a matter of fact, I don't know. If you look, you can find the week that Madison was missing, but Madison's back. And Madison now, on June 14th, is going to address everybody. And this address is down to page 201. And this is a basic note that he's kind of talking about. Let me see here. I think they're talking about the compensation of the legislatures and so forth, or as far as the government goes. So let's go into this real quick. Go ahead.
Mr. Chairman, let me ask those who oppose this part of the system whether any alteration would not make it equally or more liable to objections. Would it be better to fix their compensations? Would it not this produce inconveniences? What authorizes us to conclude that the value of coins would continue always the same? Would it be prudent to make them dependent on the state governments for their salaries, on those who watch them with jealous eyes and who consider them as encroaching, not on the people, but on themselves? But the worthy member supposes that Congress will fix their wages so low that only the rich can fill the offices of senators and representatives. Who are to appoint them? The rich? No, sir. The people are to choose them. If the members of the general government were to reduce their compensations to a trifle before the evil suggested could happen, the people could elect other members in their stead who would alter that regulation. The people do not choose them for their wealth. If the state legislatures choose such men as senators, it does not influence the people at large in their election of the representatives. They can choose those who have the most merit and least wealth. If Congress reduced their wages to a trifle, what shall prevent the state from giving a man of merit so much as will be adequate?
Adequate compensation.
Got me. Okay. Adequate compensation. I think the evil is very remote, and if it were now to happen, the remedy is in our hands and may by ourselves be applied.
Now, just to be clear, How many times have you seen a meme in social media that says Congress was originally paid by a per diem and that the states paid that per diem? The fact is, under the Constitution, the Continental Congress was paid by a per diem. Many of the states couldn't pay it, and they tried to send rich people to serve, and they had problems getting people to even attend. They had problems because it was left to the states. Going through the Constitutional Convention, they were very clear that they would be paid out of the Treasury, that they would be compensated for their time. The concept of a possible per diem, whatever their expenses were, or what have you, because that's the implication of a per diem. A per diem is not a compensation for your time. A per diem is literally just covering your costs and expenses, food, allowances, travel, hotel, that type of stuff. It's not compensating you for the amount of work and time you're spending, right?
That is correct.
So
it is to defray the cost.
So when the Constitution was written, they solved this problem by saying that the legislature, as well as the president, as well as the judges or the jurists, would be compensated for their time out of the Treasury. In other words, they would receive a wage. Now, why is it that people read this garbage and they just believe it? It's just misinformation. And I'm here to tell you, folks, that when we really look at the wages of a legislator, should the wages of a judge be so much more than the legislature? Let me ask you this, put it and frame it this way. When you have to look at creating the law and ensuring that the law is one just, as well as clear and well-defined and so forth, the judge doesn't do that. The judge basically just sits there, receives the law, and judges a case of where that law might be broken in a controversy between one party and another. So in other words, how much brain power is necessary for a judge to determine the outcome of a case, of a controversy? Where how much brain power is necessary in creating a law, standards of, the behavior of the militia, so forth and so on. When you look at some of the laws that Congress needs to make, a uniform rule of naturalization, the judges, they're not creating the law, and yet we don't want to give our legislators anything. So no wonder that these guys go in and they work hard. They try to create good laws. Let's just say that's what they're doing. But they're being compensated for crap. As a matter of fact, I can tell you many states, go to state New Hampshire, I don't believe that they are hardly compensated at all. There are many states that undercompensate their state legislatures. But the problem isn't really compensation as it is the fact that they're creating laws that they shouldn't be making. This goes back to, to get on top of this and to, make sure that we actually do have legislatures where when legislation is being done, they should be compensated. But we shouldn't compensate them for a year or two when legislation isn't required. We don't need new legislation every year. This is that game of the self-licking ice cream cone, if you know what I mean. Bottom line, they should, when necessary to create a law, then okay. They should be compensated for the laws that they create. But just to show up and to just do some work or what have you, that's something different. Does that make sense? And I honestly think that, they don't even need to show up at the state legislature anymore. I think because we can work virtually, we can really cut down the costs as well. And maybe some of the per diem could go away to where we're only really compensating them for their time to connect in the meetings, to maybe decide in committees and those types of things. And that's it. But I do believe that when it comes to legislation in creating law, for them to actually do a good job in that. And by the way, it should be illegal for me to be able to create legislation. It should be illegal for lobbyists to be able to create legislation. They're the ones that have to, they're the ones that are supposed to do it. They're hired by we the people when we vote them in to create our laws. And yet they just turn right around like a revolving door and just bring in legislation from other people, and then they sponsor it, they take credit for it. Our entire process, if we actually started implementing constitutional compliance committees and started really looking at how our representation is really working and how it should be working in the view of this new paradigm of a virtual world and using technology and so forth, I truly believe that our government would be like a well-tuned machine, like a Rolls-Royce V12, you know, just humming away. Now, because of the Rolls-Royce is built in Britain, that doesn't mean it wouldn't have, you know, electrical problems and leaking oil all over the place because they have those systemic problems. but anyway, let's get back to now. This is June 14th, by the way, folks. And I've been telling you that this is really where they get heavy into the militia. And this is some of the most, I'm only highlighting some of the most important parts that are being brought up. And so George Mason is the first, just like George Mason was the first in the convention to bring up the militia. Here we go. George Mason is bringing it up, and he is really bringing it home as we go through this. And let's just start with the militia and how to abandon it. He's laying out the recipe of how the militia can be abandoned unconstitutionally, not legitimately, but unconstitutionally. So let's go ahead.
Mr. Chairman, unless there be some restrictions on the power of calling forth the militia to execute the laws of the Union, suppress insurrections, and repel invasions, we may very easily see that it will produce dreadful oppressions. It is extremely unsafe without some alterations. It would be to use the militia to a very bad purpose if any disturbance happened in New Hampshire to call them from Georgia. This would harass the people so much that they would agree to abolish the use of the militia and establish a standing army. I conceive the general government ought to have power over the militia, but it ought to have some bounds. If gentlemen say that the militia of a neighboring state is not sufficient, the government ought to have the power to call forth those of other states the most convenient and contiguous. But in this case, the consent of the state legislatures ought to be had.
Okay,
on real emergencies,
so
this
Sean, let me interrupt you real quick, because you've heard me say that the army, establishing the army and pulling, calling forth and erecting an army is contingent upon the militia. And so Mason is really, he's actually laying it out, not saying that they could just go do it. He's saying right here, because this is what you read, this would harass the people so much that they would agree to abolish the use of the militia and establish an army, a standing army. The whole point of the militia was to keep that from ever happening. The whole point of it was to do that. Now, the other thing that I want to point out is this idea of taking the militia away and deploying it not over to France. He's complaining about taking it from Georgia up to New Hampshire on U.S. soil. In other words, they didn't want to see their militia deployed very far out of state, but there was never one mention, not a tittle, where the militia would ever be deployed out of the United States. It was never designed to do that. And I'm just trying to highlight these points because you just covered a couple. Now, people, as you listen, keep this in the, keep this forefront in your mind and eyes as we read through this, and you show me where this concept of one deploying outside the United States, or, you know, the concept of the want of being able to deploy for long periods of time the militia at all. They wanted to limit and confine the federal government to only doing those things necessary. Go ahead.
On real emergencies, this consent would never be denied, each state being concerned in the safety of the rest. This power may be restricted without any danger. I wish such an amendment as this, that the militia of any state should not be marched beyond the limits of the adjoining state, and if it be necessary to draw them from one end of the continent to the other, I wish such a check as the consent of the state legislature to be provided. Gentlemen may say that this would impede the government and that state legislatures would counteract it by refusing their consent. This argument may be applied to all objections whatsoever. How is this compared to the British Constitution? Though the king may declare war, the parliament has the means of carrying it on. It is not so here. Congress can do both. Were it not for that check in the British government, the monarch would be a despot. When a war is necessary for the benefit of the nation, the means of carrying it on are never denied. If any unjust requisition be made on Parliament, it will be, as it ought to be, refused. The same principle ought to be observed in our government. In times of real danger, the states will have the same enthusiasm in aiding the general government and granting its demands, which is seen in England, when the king is engaged in a war apparently for the interest of the nation. This power is necessary, but we ought to guard against danger. If they ever attempt to harass and abuse the militia, they may abolish them and raise a standing army in their stead. There are various ways of destroying the militia. A standing army may be perpetually established in their stead. I abominate and detest the idea of a government where there is a standing army. The militia may be here destroyed by that method which has been practiced in other parts of the world before. That is, by rendering them useless, by disarming them, under various pretenses. Congress may neglect to provide for arming and disciplining the militia, and the state government cannot do it, for Congress has an exclusive right to arm them, etc. Here is a line of division drawn between them, the state and general governments. The power over the militia is divided between them. The national government has an exclusive right to provide for arming, organizing, and disciplining the militia, and for governing such part of them as may be employed in the service of the United States. The state governments have the power of appointing the officers and of training the militia according to the discipline prescribed by Congress, if they should think proper to prescribe any. Should the national government wish to render the militia useless, they may neglect them and let them perish in order to have a pretense of establishing a standing army.
Okay, so in this last green section, there's the little recipe of what it would take for them to basically violate the Constitution by creating a standing army. Did that happen? Yes. That's exactly what happened when they started creating the cavalry and started basically protecting the states and occupying the states. And so, like I said, folks, it's one thing for them to call forth the militia to go out to a territory to kind of secure that until states are erected, and then those people would be discharged, and then they would call forth a new group of people. But it's easier if you maintain the same staff because they have the domain knowledge. They know each other. They know how to work with each other. They're already pretty well disciplined and so forth. But by doing so, they are actually ignoring and creating a complacency amongst the states by actually telling the states you don't even have to have a militia to guard yourself. As a matter of fact, why didn't the territories, you know, the first thing they do? And the first thing that the federal government did in establishing the territories was establishing a judge for law and order and control. Why didn't the next thing that they do is say, okay, you're going to have to form a militia, and we're going to send out some, you know, some troops initially, but you're going to have to guard yourself. And we will, you know, we will provide minor support. But instead, they became fully, the territories became fully dependent upon the standing army. And there you go, folks. So when it came down to the Civil War, the states weren't ready, weren't capable, and the militia was both impotent and inept. One of the reasons why the South did so well is because the South had been occupying the majority of the people that were serving in the standing army of the Union were the Southerners. Let's keep going. Now the red part.
No man has a greater regard for the military gentlemen than I have. I admire their intrepidity, perseverance, and valor. But when once a standing army is established in any country, the people lose their liberty. When against a regular and disciplined army, yeomanry are the only defense. Yeomanry unskilled and unarmed. What chance is there for preserving freedom? Give me leave to recur to the page of history to warn you of your present danger. Recollect the history of most nations of the world. What havoc, desolation, and destruction have been perpetrated by standing armies. An instant within the memory of some of this house will show us how our militia may be destroyed. 40 years ago, when the resolution of enslaving America was formed in Great Britain, the British Parliament was advised by an artful man who was governor of Pennsylvania to disarm the people, that it was the best and most effectual way to enslave them, but they should not do it openly, but weaken them and let them sink gradually by totally disusing and neglecting the militia. Here Mr. Mason quoted sundry passages to this effect. This was a most iniquitous project. Why should we not provide against the danger of having our militia, our real and natural strength, destroyed? The general government ought, at the same time, to have some such power. But we need not give them power to abolish our militia. If they neglect to arm them and prescribe proper discipline, they will be of no use. I am not acquainted with the military profession. I beg to be excused for any errors I may commit with respect to it. But I stand on the general principles of freedom, whereon I dare to meet anyone. I wish that in case of the general government should neglect to arm and discipline the militia, there should be an express declaration that the state governments might arm and discipline them. With this single exception, I would agree to this part, as I am conscious the government ought to have the power. They may affect the destruction of the militia by rendering the service odious to the people themselves, by harassing them from one end of the continent to the other, and by keeping them under martial law. The English Parliament never passed a mutiny bill but for 1 year. This is necessary, for otherwise the soldiers would be on the same footing with the officers, and the army would be dissolved. One mutiny bill has been here in force since the Revolution. I humbly conceive there is extreme danger of establishing cruel martial regulations. If at any time our rulers should have unjust and iniquitous designs against our liberties and should wish to establish a standing army, the first attempt would be to render the service and use of militia odious to the people themselves, subjecting them to an unnecessary severity of discipline in time of peace, confining them under martial law, and disgusting them so much as to make them cry out, "Give us a standing army." I would wish to have some check to exclude this danger, as that the militia should never be subject to martial law, but in time of war. I consider and fear the natural propensity of rulers to oppress the people. I wish only to prevent them from doing evil. By these amendments, I would give necessary powers, but no unnecessary power. If the clause stands as it is now, it will take from the state legislatures what divine providence has given to every individual, the means of self-defense. Unless it be moderated in some degree, it will ruin us and introduce a standing army.
Okay, so he makes some really good points. And so what I'm going to do is I'm going to expound on some of the problems of his points But more importantly, we only have so much time, and Madison makes better points. Madison basically shuts him down. So let me kind of point out a couple of things that kind of really jump out here. He says, first off, and you've heard me say this, once a standing army is established in any country, the people lose their liberty, because all of a sudden you have a competition of who bears arms. They don't want you to bear arms because that means that you can shoot at them. They want to have exclusive control over the express use of deadly force, which is a surrendering of liberty outright. The next thing, 40 years ago, he goes through this 40 years history of how it was done even in America, where they disarmed the people. Interestingly enough, Pennsylvania, you know, Amish country and all that. And so they kind of go through how that was, you know, that was just terrible. The other point, he says, I stand on the general principles of freedom whereon I dare to meet anyone. I wish that in the case of the general government should neglect to arm and discipline the militia, there should be an express declaration that the state governments might arm and discipline them. Well, hold on here. There's a clear declaration, and I've said this. There's a clear declaration that they have to pay for the army. They have to pay for the training. The states do the training, but the arming, organizing, disciplining, and all of that is directed by the federal government, but everything is done by the states. Therefore, when the federal government fails to do it, doesn't mean the states can't do it, but more importantly, the states have a right, because the federal government is supposed to be funding it. They have a right to put requisitions to the state or to the federal government and say, look, we've done your job. Now you have to pay us, compensate us, or we're withholding these taxes, period. And 9 times out of 10, it would probably be allowing the negation of the obligations of taxes. Why have the state give money and then the federal government give money back? Hey, you've canceled out that debt. Great. Done. Moving on, because we only have so much time here, they may affect the destruction of the militia by rendering the service odious to the people, by keeping them, by harassing them and keeping them in service and going from one end of the continent to another, and by keeping them under martial law. So martial law all of a sudden becomes, the first time really discussed out of all of the ratification debates. It's not a coincidence that at least it was covered, but they covered it in detail here. Can they declare martial law based on what he's saying? Can they just declare it? Can they just come right out and say, we're declaring martial law and we're dragging you around and we're going to keep you under tight scrutiny that you have no rights as a member of the army and we're in full control of you. Don't dare leave us or we will, we'll hang you. That type of level of tyranny. So when we come back, folks, I hope I've just prime this well enough for you to say, when we come back, James Madison is going to basically, get into the ring and he is going to take all of these assertions with, just like I used metaphorically with Nicholas, he's going to left, right, jab, all around the ring and pummel everything that George Mason said. I'm G.R. Mobley, but Reclaim the Republic, and we need your help. God bless.
If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review as well as my description of the Republic Review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how Republic Review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you.